House Resources Committee to order. The time is 1 p.m. Today is Monday, April 29th. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Tuck, Representative Sarah Hannan, Vice Chair Representative Greyer Hopkins, Co-Chair Representative John Lincoln, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Want to thank our LIO moderator, Douglas Bridges. Thank you for your help. And Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, thank you. Appreciate you helping us out all the time. And if we could ask members to please silence their cell phones as we get started, we'd appreciate that. We have a busy agenda with a couple of bills today that are first-time hearings in the committee. First is Senate Bill 43, extend the Big Game Commercial Services Board. And it's not just a simple extension bill anymore because there's been additional sections added to it. And so we'll talk about that. And then it'll be the first hearing on HB 138, National Resource Water Designation. So the first order of business is Senate Bill 43. So Senator Wilson, we'd love to welcome you to the House Resources Committee.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Senator Wilson for District D. And Madam Chair, I just want to say this is still a simple bill, still same title.
Okay.
Before we get started here, Senate Bill 43 does extend the termination of the Big Game Commercial Services Board until June 30th of 2024, which is 1 year less than the legislative six-year audit recommendation that was changed in Senate Finance. This board consists of two licensed registered guide outfitters, two licensed transporters, two private land holders, two public members, and one member from the Board of Game. Legislative audit conducted their review of the board and made three recommendations to improve the board. Please note these three recommendations are within the purview of the division and not in purview of the board. The audit findings and recommendations, the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing's director should improve the management and oversight of procedures to ensure the documentation is obtained and reviewed and retained to support licensure. They also make the recommendation that the chief investigators of the division should increase oversight to improve the timeliness of investigations. Multiple agencies are involved in this and extends the times, which makes this very complex. But at the time, they had, as of to date, they only have 37 open cases. And of those 37, 13 are Alaska Wildlife Trooper cases, and that they have no control over in terms of the timeliness because they try to wait till those are fully adjudicated and went through the disposition process before the board makes recommendations on that process. And the Office of the Governor and Boards and Commission Directors should work with the board to identify potential applications in a timely manner. It was recognized that more supervisory reporting is needed for more quality control. The department has worked in adding supervisors in addition to the examiner, and they're working to improve training procedures. There's a new chief investigator with two new senior investigators were added to provide more quality assurance. They have heard the message from the legislative audit, and they are working to hold investigations accountable for the paperwork. And with us today also for Lifelines, our legislative auditor, Chris Curtis, is available to answer questions, as well as the director of this division, Ms. Sarah Chambers. With that, Madam Chair, I can go through a sectional summary if you'd like.
Let's see. Let me just welcome Representative Tallarico, who joined us at 1:03 p.m. Welcome. Does anybody have any questions right now before we go into the sectional? And we will have Ms. Curtis come up and walk through the audit and get the recommendations from her, too. Okay. So we can hold that. But any questions as we get started here? Okay. Then we would do the sectional.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 1 amends ASO8.03.010 C9 to extend the Board of Game Services to June 30th, 2024, page 1, lines 6 through 8. Section 2 starts on page 1, 9 through 14, continue on page 2, lines 1 through 16. This will allow the Board to immediately suspend licensure violations for already qualified persons from receiving or renewing that license. Section 3 starts on page 2, lines 17 through 31, continuing on page 3, lines 1 through 7, amends, this increases the minimum qualifications for a Master Guide Outfitter license, including the requirement to have a clean record for 15 years. Section 4 adds the new subsections, which starts on page 3, lines 8 through 17, which allows the board to revoke a master guise license outfitter if the person's privileges are revoked or if the person is convicted of a violation. And a person who has a master guise outfitter license is revoked under the provision can still be issued a registered guide license if qualified. And section 5 is the immediate date clause effect. Madam Chair, the Big Game Board Commercial Services plays an important role in managing the activities of the commercial game hunters in the interest of the Alaska Wildlife Resources. This is always a complicated subject, but really the matter at hand, which we had to remind folks in our body, is that this is about whether the board should continue its functions, not sort of what the functionality of the board is. And with that, I can answer any additional questions.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Wilson. Want to recognize that Representative Rauscher joined us at 1:05 p.m. Welcome. And so that was a pretty fast sectional for me as I was following along. So section 1 is clearly the extension. Now section 2, and I thought maybe if we could just slow this down for one moment. So the change really in section 2 is just adding the word hold to that section of statute. So it's not about the initial receiving or renewing, but it's putting a restriction on even someone who's holding a license if they have these other problems that are in the later sections. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone else have any questions about section 2? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. I guess my question is sort of broadly, is this a problem that we have real life scenarios in which the board wanted to act and could not act, or the audit found that we should have acted and didn't act, or are we being speculative in nature? That there are bad actors who we didn't have a hammer for.
Through the chair, in the Senate Finance Committee, when talking about some of the issues of with the holdup of licenses, and sometimes you can have someone go from the time of a violation to the time of investigation and through the court system, you're looking at maybe 2.5 years plus that timeline, plus through the appeals process. This is after someone's found guilty and goes through the appeal process that their license can't be put on hold. This question was asked upon, I believe the chair of the committee, Senate Finance, asked the board what other additional tools would be helpful in helping this process out to make sure that you don't have a bad actor continually to provide guiding services during this time period. So in those type of rare situations, they would still go to the board to make that decision, more than to put a hold on someone's license after that time of adjudication, but before the appeal process is finished going through the process.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, through the chair. So there were real-world examples in which they said we didn't have the right tool to hold this license, and we had a real case where, because it wasn't yet adjudicated, we couldn't discipline. And I'm seeing Ms. Chambers nodding her head, so I'm going to take that as we had a real-life example, and this fixes that.
Yes, through the chair, Rep. Hannon, that is correct. We have several real-life examples.
And I just want to make note that Henry Tiffany, the chair of the Big Game Commercial Services Board, is online, and so at any point, if you want me to reach out to him, then let me know. Want to recognize that Representative Sponholz joined us at 1:07 p.m., and then Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello, Senator. Thanks for coming. On page 2 of the CS that was that we're addressing today, on the bottom, page 29 through 31, it has the new numbers of clients who have to come in person or say that or give an evaluation of the Big Game Guide. It has to be a favorable evaluation. What qualifies as a favorable evaluation, and what process is that? I assume it's not a Yelp review. It's something more substantial than that.
Yes, and I would like to defer to the actual practitioner of the licensor. I believe Mr. Henry is on the phone.
Okay, and we'll go to him. So this is in Section 3. Henry Tiffany? Mr. Tiffany? Were you able to hear the question?
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I was, and I'm losing my voice, so I'll apologize if it cracks in advance.
No problem. We can hear you. And if you don't mind looking at lines 29 to 31 and helping us understand the new language and what qualifies for that.
I would be happy to answer the question very directly. I would actually defer to Ms. Chambers because the board doesn't handle the applications. So I can't tell you exactly how it's written and what the review specifically entails, because the division does handle that. But there was much discussion on these changes by the board as a whole, much deliberation, robust conversation, and they were all voted on and unanimously in support by the board for these different changes. So the increase in the number of favorable recommendations is not a large increase, but it's more standard. I know in some of the military branches, you need to be in a particular position for 15 or more years, and there are other professions that hold the same. So we felt it was appropriate to move that up, as well as the favorable number of favorable recommendations to hold a master guide license. But again, if you don't mind, to get a very specific answer, I would defer to Ms. Chambers on exactly what is required besides a good Yelp review to comply with that.
Ms. Chambers, could you join us at the table here? And the next couple sections look like they could be things that you may have something to offer. So if you wouldn't mind just putting yourself on the record, and then if you have some additional thoughts on that, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And the vetting process for a master guide includes the applicant, who must already be a registered guide, sending us a list of clients, and then we will follow up with those clients and request information that's pertinent to their proficiency in the field that would relate to the scope of what a guide outfitter is allowed to do. That it's a wide scope. Guides, especially at the registered or contracting guide, where they're not assisting, they're in charge, the registered and master guide level, they are in charge of people's lives. They ensure that they can't ensure that you're going to get something when you're out hunting for that something, but they do need to make sure that you're adequately cared for, that your safety is cared for, that you are in compliance with all applicable laws and regulations, not only of hunting but of the land use for that area. So we ask questions regarding the client's awareness, and it is more sophisticated than a Yelp review, but it essentially comes down to, tell us about your experience. And so the board had an opportunity to review the CS in an early draft form because they were fortunate enough to be meeting at the same time. So they went through and felt that these were reasonable updates, and augmenting the numbers would just give more of an opportunity for people to tell us more about that guide's experience and proficiency to rise to the highest level of master guide.
Okay. Any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Is there a time period over which those 45 clients have had to work with that guide or go with them?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, I am not sure if there is a window of time. Mr. Tiffany might be able to answer to that. We'll go back and forth. I have the administrative part. He has the qualitative part. My understanding through working on this bill is that it would be during the life of their registered guide outfitter license. So it would be someone who had contracted with them. The structure of guiding goes from an assistant guide to a Class A guide, assistant guide, to a registered guide, to a master guide. So the dividing line between the two assistants and the two what we kind of refer to as contracting guides is that they're the boss, and they actually sign the contract with the client. So it would need to be within the life of their their registered guide activity, but I'm not sure off the top of my head if there is a window, if it has to be within a last period of time, unless otherwise stated in the bill.
Mr. Tiffany?
Yes, Madam. This is Henry Tiffany, for the record, Chairman of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. For a client to qualify as a name submitted for a master guide application, the registered guide at that point doesn't necessarily have to have been the contracting guide for that individual client, because there are many guides within Alaska that some don't ever contract hunts. They work for other registered or master guides, but they still may choose to try to attain a master guide license, and we certainly wouldn't want to hinder that. And so if they have physically guided a client in the field, then that client's name would be applicable for them to put on their application towards a master guide license. And I don't believe there is any stipulation that that it needs to be within, you know, a couple of years, because it fits the number of clients divided by the number of years proposed, I believe, comes to 3 clients a year, which is not a lot of clients. Most guides that guide either contract or guide clients for someone else to at least 3 or more a year. So it's a pretty reasonable number. Does that help to answer your question?
I believe so, Mr. Tiffany. So just to repeat back at you to make sure I understand, there is no window for how many of those for the time frame for that, for those 45 people to give their evaluations from the department, the division. It just has to be, it could be any time in the last 40 years if that person has been a registered guide or a guide outfitter, correct? So there's just really no time frame, but 3 out of 5 is a logical number, or 3 per year.
Yes, through the chair, I do believe, to my knowledge, there's no limitation. If it took you 40 years to collect the right number of names, then so be it. Or if it took you less, then that's all right also.
Okay, thank you. And then probably another follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Probably this one's probably for the department. So your process is you call these 45 people. Is that standard for providing a occupational license for the division? Are there other places that other types of licenses that require that type of work by the department, the division?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, we'll solicit that information for a variety of our license types. It really depends on how the statute is written. We do have quite a few license types that require some sort of a affidavit that I supervised this person and they were able to competently perform the duties in this role, and that may be on a healthcare side, some of our professions on the healthcare side, but also non-healthcare, like a mechanical administrator or an electrical administrator. We also have that sort of I can't think of the word of it. I should know it, but a evaluation by someone who has supervised or worked closely with that person in a similar capacity. So it's unusual because it is somewhat subjective, but it is pertinent and relevant to that type of work.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. And I want to continue on this line because it seems to me that this is a huge jump in the number of clients that both have to be submitted, and they could be over I was reading it as a 20-year span of your career, but now you're saying it could be over a 40-year span, and that you have to have a favorable evaluation of 30 of them. And, of course, over a 40-year span or a 20-year span, one, my assumption is some of those clients are no longer alive and that these guides aren't using – they're not carrying 20 clients in a year, probably, more in the realm of 10. many of them foreign nationals. And it seems like this is a huge increase in both the burden for the agency to make contact with them and get a response, because previously it was 10 favorable responses. So almost a threefold increase of you having to find these people, get a favorable response before we can go to a master license. And I'm wondering if we are narrowing it so much that we're hardly going to get anybody who can ever qualify, because our threshold of who has to respond favorably in a timely fashion, because I can't imagine that the Alaska Department of Occupational Licensing calling a German national and saying, I need to interview you about a hunt you took 15 years ago, is a quick conversation.
Who would like to respond to that?
I'll start.
Okay.
And I think Ms. Chambers could probably give a better example and an issue to this. So when talking with the guides, you know, the master guide is a title that people may want to pay more for. It's a higher prestige. It's the best of the best. And with that comes additional privileges. And they want to make that a higher benchmark for guides to obtain. And so that's why you see the sort of the guidelines on they can't have any violations in the past 15 years or other issues, because they want to make sure that when outside folks are buying services from these individuals, they want to make sure that these are the top ethical folks that are going to follow the guidelines and regulations, and they want to make sure that they've had a great success story. And so they just want to set the bar higher to obtain this master guide license.
And Ms. Chambers, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Wilson is correct. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the master guide is a somewhat of an honorary title. The registered guide can perform the same guide outfitting duties as a master guide. So it's not, when we were reviewing this, we asked ourselves the same questions and really deferred to the board, which vetted this. Does this seem reasonable? And it is not prohibiting anyone from gaining a higher level of economic opportunity, because the master and the register guides can do the same things. But the master guide does have that value added, as Senator Wilson said, that it is a title recognizing that you are at the very top of your game. It doesn't get in the United States any more exclusive in the guiding industry than that, but it is not a tier where we might look at trade issues and restriction of trade by saying this is really hard to get and it might serve only an elite few, which is preventing everyone here from being able to earn the same living. They're on the same par, at least as far as their economic opportunities are concerned. Does that help?
Follow?
It helps to some degree, but I guess you as the we've always had a threshold that had to have, and previously it was 10 out of 25 clients over a 12 to 15 year period. We're increasing both the look back period that you can submit clients from, and we are tripling the number of positive responses. So is the fiscal note attached of 35,000, you believe that will adequately give the department the time to do the investigation of an additional 20 positive evaluations on every one of these applications, and there's not that many on an annual basis, and that the guides who are potentially qualified to apply for this already feel like they can produce those names and have current contact, that client wasn't from 15 years ago and no longer in contact? Because it just seems like, if this is something the department said, we really got to up our game of how many evaluations we're looking at, then great. But I'm hearing it that we in our infinite wisdom thought we need to increase the standard, and I'm not sure if we've been missing people and they weren't getting them, but it just seems like a big leap to me in the volume. And so I want to make sure that we are doing it for the right reason, not just we had a couple of people with lower licenses who are bad actors, because that's sort of a separate issue. These are the best of the best, and they shouldn't get poor evaluations. You aren't likely to stay a master guide charging what you do if you're getting poor evaluations when your German client returns home and says, the guy was a Yahoo. You're not going to stay in business. But both the board, the industry, and the department think these thresholds are manageable.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the department administratively doesn't see a problem with increasing our workload. I'm sure the chairman, Mr. Tiffany, could speak to the board's discussion and vetting of those numbers, which included master guides.
Okay. So I want to ask Mr. Tiffany for a response. I want to make note that Representative Rasmussen joined us at 1:18 p.m., and then Representative Tuck and Sponholz have questions after that. Mr. Tiffany?
Yes, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Chambers was very correct that a master guide license, more than anything, is an honorary title. It does not allow, from an economic standpoint, an individual to necessarily do anything more than a registered guide can do, except that a master guide can advertise themselves and carry themselves with that title. The board in its discussion understands this, and 35 names submitted with 30 favorable recommendations over a 15-year period, because you must have been a registered guide for at least 15 years. So that's guiding, as I mentioned previously, 3 clients a year. That is a very feasible number, and many guides, I know of some guides that guide 10 to 15 clients in 1 year. So we don't think it's an erroneous or a burden on an applicant that wants to attain the title because they have proven under these proposed changes that they have been exemplary in the profession for a long time with no violations. And the board was in agreement, unanimous agreement on that, and doesn't feel it's terribly burdensome. One of the board members is currently a registered guide, is getting close to, under the current regulations, to being eligible to apply for their master guide license. And he fully understands that this would prolong the time it takes him to apply for a master guide license, and yet he voted in full support of these changes. Does that help to answer and clarify any of your questions?
I'm fine. Thank you.
That's exactly what Representative Hannon wanted to hear. Thank you. We will go next to Representative Tuck. Had a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to make sure I understand this correctly, right now, currently, if I have a master's guide license and I commit a offense under ASO 854720A, that I do not lose my license. I can continue on as I'm not lose my license, but continue with my status or my title of master guide. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, which section?
Currently. Oh, I'm just reading I'm on page 3. I'm just referring to that statute that we're adding, item number 4.
About under revocation the, of the
yeah,
violation.
Page number 3. I'm sorry, page number 3, item number 4 at the very top. I'm referring to that statute. So what I'm asking is, currently, if I'm a master guide and I commit an offense underneath this statute, I don't lose my title. Is that correct? Currently.
Title, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Tuck, are you referring to not losing your title as a master guide or just losing your guide license?
No, losing my title as a master guide.
So currently, you would not lose your title as a master guide if you committed an offense.
Okay. So what I, if I may, Madam Chair, what I appreciate about this is that we do have conditions where somebody can actually lose their master guide title if they, once they get that title, they do commit some violations. So I guess my next question is, if I do lose my license, looks like Section 4 there, L allows me to at least still have my guide outfitter license, so I can still guide. However, I would have to wait 15 years of having a clean record before getting that master title returned to me. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Tuck, yes.
Representative, thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Sponholz.
I wanted to ask if the evaluations could be done via a survey, rather than if you have to have, you know, if you have to have a 45 clients that give you, and of those, 30 of those have to give you favorable evaluation. Do those have to be done in an interview format, as I think that I heard Representative Hannon referencing, or could those be done in the form of a written or an online survey?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, I can double check with staff. I'm pretty sure that they're contacted in writing. It would make me a little anxious to believe that someone's license depends on verbal note-taking. So I'm certain there's a written record of that, but I don't know specifically what that looks like.
Okay, just to clarify, though, it's not that we have people that are calling and interviewing 40 former clients, that there's, in fact, a process, an administrative process, where a letter is sent out with the opportunity for clients to respond back with their feedback.
Yes, to respond in writing in that manner, yes.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you.
Do you want to ask the board chair any questions about that?
Nope.
Okay. Any other questions here on the sectional, on sections three or four there from committee members? Okay, then maybe we could invite Ms. Curtis up to walk us through the audit. And Ms. Chambers probably shouldn't go too far away after from any other additional questions or committee discussion.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. I believe you all have a copy of the sunset audit of the Big Game Commercial Services Board dated September 2018. The purpose of a sunset audit is to determine whether a board or commission is serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. So for this board, we found that they are serving the public's interest by conducting meetings in accordance with applicable laws, by amending regulations to improve the occupations under their purview, and by supporting changes made by the Department of Law to improve the timeliness of the disciplinary process. Additionally, we found this board had eliminated the over $1 million deficit that the 2015 sunset audit reported. But we also concluded that the board licenses were not consistently supported by adequate documentation, a high number of investigations had unjustified periods of inactivity, and three board positions were vacant for an extended period. So we recommended a six-year extension for this board. If you're in the audit and you turn to page 8, you will see a schedule of licensing activity. As of May 2018, there was a total of 1,219 active licenses. This represents a 20% reduction when compared to the 2015 sunset audit. According to the board chair, the decrease is due in part to guides retiring and a decreased interest in the profession. Additionally, the chair reported that there were less transporters because many changed operating as air taxis to avoid the transporters' reporting requirements and fees. As of April 2015, there were 151 licensed transporters. This is compared to 90 as of May 2018, which is a 40% reduction in the number of transporters. If you turn to page 10, you will see the schedule of revenues and expenditures. It shows the board had a surplus of just over $132,000 at the end of FY18. And this, again, is significant as they had a deficit of over $1 million at the end of FY15. We do have three recommendations for improvements. They begin on page 14. First, we recommend the DCBPL director improve management procedures to ensure required documentation is obtained, reviewed, and retained to support licensure. So we tested 25 new licenses, and we found errors in 14 of them. You can see the errors listed on page 14. The more serious were missing background checks and a lack of adequate investigatory review. According to DCBPL management, there was turnover in the staff that supported the board, which contributed to the errors. The audit also noted a lack of adequate supervisory review. Recommendation number 2 is on page 15. We recommend DCBPL's chief investigator increase oversight to increase the timeliness of the investigations. We tested 22 investigations that had been open for over 180 days during the audit period and found unjustified periods of inactivity for 20 of the 22. According to the chief investigator, periods of inactivity were due, in part, to a lack of adequate resources to investigate the high caseload, and supervisors not adequately monitoring the cases. Recommendation number three is on page 16. We recommend Office of the Governor work with the board to identify potential applicants in a timely manner. So from July of 2015 through May of 2018, there was a licensed transporter board position and a private landholder board position that were vacant for 6 months due to the inability to identify interested applicants. Furthermore, one board position occupied by the member of the Board of Game was vacant for over 8 months because Office of the Governor was not notified of the vacancy. According to board and commission staff, the licensed transporters and the private landholder board positions are difficult to fill due to a lack of qualified candidates. Responses to the audit begin on page 25. The commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development agree with recommendations number 1 and 2 and have stated that they did have taken action to resolve both recommendations. You have Office of the Governor responded to recommendation number 3 beginning on page 27. They agree to work to fill vacancies in a timely manner. And the chair of the Big Game Commercial Services Board responded on page 29. The chair agrees to work with Office of the Governor to fill vacancies in a timely manner and did state that all the board positions were filled at that time.
Questions? Representative Tuck and then Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for walking us through this most recent audit. When was the audit previous to this one?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I want to say May of 2015.
And if I may, Madam Chair, were some of the issues that we have here with this last audit the same issues that we had in 2015?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, if you turn to page 13, there's a list of the prior audit recommendations. We did feel that most of them were addressed, especially the $1 million deficit. The first recommendation had to do with support to the board. And we felt that the board support did improve, but again, we did identify a new problem with the license documentation. So we consider that a reiteration of a prior recommendation. They had some problems with their prior applications. They dealt with that. They addressed the deficit, but the timeliness of the investigations was a finding in the prior audit that has not been addressed.
Okay, and other question, mm-hmm. Madam Chair? Who does the investigations? Does the board do the investigations themselves, or do they hire someone to do investigations? Or is it through the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, it is the investigations themselves are conducted by the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing staff. And the board's role is to basically stay out of the investigative process as they perform a sort of a semi-judicial role in ruling on those results in the investigation once they bring it to the board.
And follow up, Madam Chair. So I understand that the Department of Law is sucking up a lot of the investigation positions from different departments. How is this going to affect in trying to resolve the backload that we have?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I don't think we know right now the impact of that. There has been an administrative order to consolidate the investigative process within the Department of Law. And it's my understanding this board is included in that process. I know that there has been some discussion to have an audit on that process, looking at the consolidation, how that impacts timeliness, efficiency, and I believe there's work right now being to draft an audit request.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Representative Tuck started my line of questioning, and that was the idea that we are taking all the investigators from all of the agencies and consolidating the Department of Law. Is the audit that's being requested of the process of the new consolidated investigations prior to them being done, or we're going to give it some time and then audit whether we think it's a more efficient way to do it?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I suggest at least 3 years.
Okay, so we won't know for 3 years.
Follow-up.
You know, when we look at an audit that has a prior recommendation on an item, and I guess you are informing us that this is an ongoing issue, and I guess my concern is if this board in five more years has an audit that again raises that there's a problem with the investigation, but this time we've sort of structurally shifted, and we won't know whether that backlog is created by it being an ongoing problem, these are complex things to investigate, or whether it was because we've shifted how we've investigated them. And so I guess it's not that I'm encouraging them to be held harmless, but it is a seems to be an area of concern for an industry that is profitable but complex and seasonal in nature, migratory in practice, and then we are trying to make sure that investigations of things that may span legal boundaries, because again, many of the clients who might be called as a witness in an investigation of bad actors in the field could be foreign nationals, so I could certainly see why these are complex investigations to carry forward. And I'm wondering whether the department has had the opportunity to share all of those concerns in a global and specific way as these dialogues about consolidating investigators to the Department of Law have happened.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, those are exactly the types of details that we look forward to working out in fiscal year 20. The task force that the administrative order, the consolidating all the investigations under the Department of Law will really kind of kick off in the beginning of 2020 and go through those many questions that will need to be asked, not only of this particular board, but of the other 43 licensing entities that we manage, as well as all of the rest around the state. I'm expecting a fulsome discussion to see exactly how that could be worked out and look at those same safeguards and tracking mechanisms. What we've seen with, and I have no crystal ball on the administrative order other than the plan is being put into place to be as thorough as what you're describing, and that it's within the realm of possibility that our investigators will become Department of Law employees and they'll retain the same knowledge and background and experience, but benefit from oversight through the Department of Law. So I think there are a variety of ways that this could look, but we are just at the very beginning of the process. One more?
Sure. And I guess perhaps this is for Ms. Curtis to sort of footnote it now, because auditors are probably the best at footnoting something and remembering where it is and coming back to it, that this has been in two audits, yet I don't know if you have any specificity of where the problems in the timeline to produce those investigations have been that can be shared with the Department of Law so it doesn't have to be relearned by a new lawyer trying to figure out how to investigate a licensure issue that is in an unusual industry. And, you know, in each of our investigative jurisdictions are unique, but I think this one is not only unique, it's quirky. And I would just urge that we make sure we've footnoted that, so when we return to this in 5 years, we don't go a third audit where the investigation backlog is overwhelming and think that we've somehow been flawed in it, because I think it is one of those places where it's going to be a weird thing for the Department of Law. You know, the legal violations, they're going to have straight up dialed in, you know, if they've been working on fish and game issues and violations. But I think that the guide industry, it's that intersect of a lot of different elements of commerce that are really unique. And want to make sure we remember that when we hold someone to task 5 years from now about not doing it right.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. And this, I believe, is for Ms. Curtis. There's a $1.1 million deficit in FY15. And they worked on that, and it's now $132,000 surplus. How does a board accumulate a $1.1 million deficit, and what sort of costs are associated with putting that deficit in place?
I'm going to defer to Ms. Chambers to address that, but just in general terms, it may involve not raising fees timely, There were some other issues as far as allocation of indirect costs over the years that were done incorrectly. So I'll address Ms. Chambers.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins, through the chair. I'm glad that this conversation at this point feels to me like ancient history. It was a painful time, circa 2012. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. We discovered at that time that that there were not adequate checks and balances in our department's accounting systems, and our division was allowed to provide incorrect information externally to our boards, to the public. It was being accounted for correctly in Access in this old state accounting system, but all of the numbers, the reports that were going out that the board was being given that we were utilizing were not tied to the accounting system, which is sort of accounting 101. So when we discovered this was happening, we worked to rectify that, worked with our admin services department, and had an exhaustive search through all data to really find out where does every licensing program really stand. And some came out ahead that they were actually doing better than what they were being told. Some were not. And this board was in the very, very not category. So much to their credit, the board at that time signed on and said, we're going to do what it takes. We know the numbers at the end of the day are accurate. We don't like what they are, but we believe in this industry and licensure, and we need to make sure that we're sucking it up and getting it done. So we spent a few years working hand in hand with the board to assess how often, as Ms. Curtis said, how often are fees being increased appropriately? Are there fees that are not being captured to cover the administrative workload that a statute requires? So we went through a period of time, particularly in the time between audits, to really calibrate those fees, and got to a place where they're now with a reasonable working surplus. They are being checked every year, as all of our licensing programs are, with our fee analysis tool, and we're in close contact with the board because they really don't want to go through that again, and neither do we.
Just one quick follow-up. So all of those new positions that the sponsor of the bill was talking about that have been brought on to address the backlog of complaints and concerns, those are all paid for out of user fees as well, and increased since 2015?
Through the chair, yes. Those are all paid for through licensing fees. All of our division costs are. And those positions are actually shared with other programs as well. The audit is a span of 3 years, and the audit is a year old now. So we're really looking back 4 years at the beginning of this window. And since the beginning of the audit, we've put into place many, many variety of safeguards and additional resources to be able to, for once and for all, address the issues that were raised in the audit. Again, as it was stated earlier, I believe, by Senator Wilson, the findings in the audit are really against my division and not against the board itself, which is a body of volunteers that are appointed to govern. The licensing, the investigative issues are on my shoulders and my team's shoulders to be accountable for. And the commissioner responded, and even to date, we have narrowed down double checks with the new senior investigators for all of our programs. We've reduced the licensing workload for this program. I brought some updated data, knowing that the audit was is a little bit dated. That we, in the just the window of early April, closed 22 cases and only have 39 cases open now. And we go through every 60 days or so to double check that there is adequate documentation in our case file, because the audit didn't find that the investigations were performed poorly or that the board wasn't doing its job. The audit found that our staff was not documenting lapses when things are over with the troopers or with the Office of Special Prosecutions, and we've taken that very seriously. We'd like for this program to have a clean audit and know that it reflects poorly on us if we're not meeting that standard.
Thank you.
Okay, just to keep us on schedule here, because we want to try to get to the next bill around 2 if we can. If there are no other questions, then we could transition into the public testimony.
Madam Chair.
Oh, pardon me. Representative Tuck has another question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to point out something that I just noticed. The audit has concerns about investigations as well as oversight and monitoring the cases. Right now, that supervision of monitoring the cases comes from Department of D-Commerce Businesses Professional Licensing. Did I get that right?
That was close.
Okay, close enough. So my concern is that now that we are pulling, because if you look at the statutes say an 0105-0 administrative duties of departments. It says here specifically provide inspection, enforcement, and investigative services to the boards for the occupations listed in 0801-010, which is number 9 is Big Game Commercial Services Board. So to me, our statutes are very specific on who investigates those and who oversees those investigations. So that the governor putting out an administrative order really, in my opinion, is an executive order, because you are changing statutes. Only administrative order can you change your structure and everything else, but if anything that deals with statute, that's an executive order. So we may have to look into that a little bit further to make sure that the governor is really allowed to pull in all those investigations. Otherwise, who is going to, I guess is my question, if the governor does pull all those investigations, Department of Law, who is now responsible for the oversight and supervisory of those and monitoring of those investigations? That's a question.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I am thinking that maybe there's a seat for you on this task force. those are going to be worked out, respectfully, those are going to be worked out through the task force, and I'll make notes of that crosswalk, and that is something that will be for this task force to figure out prior to executing the administrative order.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and we will have this bill back before us on Friday, and so if there are additional questions on that topic, perhaps we can explore someone else, because I'm not sure we have someone available today. Before we go into some of the folks that are calling in from different organizations, we have Major Bernard Chastain, the Deputy Director for Alaska Wildlife Troopers. And I just, Major Chastain, was there anything that you wanted to add? Were you just on for questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Major Chastain, I am available for questions.
Okay. So I want members to know that. And then I'd want to go next to Henry Tiffany, just if there's anything that you wanted to add based on the conversation, and then continue on with the rest of the public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I would defer to the public and let them have a few minutes to share their thoughts.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being online, and hang on, because we might have something else for you. Okay, so then first I'm going to go to Kurt Whitehead from CLOOC. Mr. Whitehead, are you available? Okay. And because we are limited on time, I will be timing folks at 2-minute cutoff.
Roger that. Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Kurt Whitehead, CLOOC, Alaska. I've been a guide in Alaska since 95. Came up through the ranks, worked for a number of good outfitters, a number of bad outfitters. I can't stress enough the importance of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. And because I only have a couple minutes, I'd like to talk about how important oral testing is. So when the applicant is applying for their registered license, they have to go before a panel of either master guides or register guides, and we're critiquing them, we're judging them, we're scoring them, and so that's when it's really apparent whether the kid knows his stuff or not, or the person. I haven't done it much other than actually one time. I've talked to many other people, but it's just vitally important that you've got the ability of other register guides to sign off and say, yeah, that guy is, he knows his stuff. He knows how to judge bears. He knows how to judge. It's not just trophy judging, but yeah, the bottom line is please vote in favor of reauthorizing the Game Commercial Services Board. There, I could go on for hours about how important it is to have some oversight, how important it is for what they do. But again, that oral testing, without the board, there would be no more oral testing. So you just sit for a multiple choice test, and then there's some geography. But anyway, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Mr. Whitehead. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, and if there's anything you want us to have in writing, please do send it along and we'll share with everyone. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Wayne Cubitt from the Alaska Pro Hunters Association.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and House Resources Committee. I'm Wayne Cubitt. I'm Vice President of Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and I'm speaking on their behalf today. Our President Sam Rohr usually testifies for us, but like most of our other members and the industry as a whole, is already out in the field guiding spring bear hunters. APHA represents Alaska's important and historic guide industry and has been in existence almost 50 years. We have been an active participant and strong proponent for state rights since our beginning. We are currently involved in rulemaking with the National Park Service to roll back changes that usurp Alaska's rights to manage game species in accordance with state goals and tradition. We recently became aware of proposed rules to restrict the use of horses in Wrangell St. Elias and are participating in that process. I have personally listened to every hearing and have read most, if not all, of the documents associated with SB 43. There is a lot of misleading and incorrect information floating around about the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and the powerful and even evil guide lobby, and their undue influence over the Board of Game and the legislature. Big picture, the guide industry pays our own way and are net positive for the state. Guided non-resident effort is less than 3% of the total big game hunting effort, but that 3% accounted for $52.5 million new dollars and $87.2 million in total economic activity with multiplier effects to the state of Alaska. This was in 2015. A lot of that occurs in rural areas. Also, as mentioned in the audit, guide numbers are decreasing, not increasing. There were complaints about the board not taking action in certain cases. I would like to point out that every meeting I go to, there are binders showing the actions they have taken. Maybe they don't get them all right away, but they certainly put a good-sized dent in them. The guide industry needs a voice that knows the truth and can represent us fairly. The Big Game Commercial Services Board is that voice and is a very important piece of the puzzle toward maintaining the long-term health and viability of the guide industry into the future. APHA strongly supports the Big Game Commercial Services Board and respectively asks you to support SB 43 and move it forward for passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cubitt. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, thank you so much. If you want to, it sounded like you're reading. If you want to send that along, we'll make sure to put it online with the letters we've received. Next, we're going to go to Mark Richards from the Resident Hunters of Alaska. Mr. Richards?
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair Tarr and Chair Lincoln and members of the Resources Committee. My name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska, and I'm here representing our 2,000 members from across the state to ask that you reject a five-year extension of the Big Game Commercial Services Board and only extend the board for 2 years. As we state in our letter dated April 25th that is in your packet, every single audit of this board since it was reinstated in 2005 has outlined the same exact problem regarding the ability to investigate cases in a timely manner and an ongoing backlog of cases that Ms. Curtis also brought up. If the board were a business that was audited for performance every 3 years, as this board has been since its reinstatement, and every audit outlined the same major problem, would you have confidence anything would change? The other body amended the extension to 5 years instead of six, but we firmly believe that it's still too long of an extension. There must be some kind of disincentive via shorter extension period, expressing to the board that the next audit better show the board has resolved its investigative issues. The additional fiscal note, especially that was attached, should result in a shorter extension to ensure that that extra money is leading to results. The other body, in part based on our complaints about guides continuing to hold a guide license after numerous violations, amended parts of the Title VIII statutes to make it somewhat easier for the board to revoke or suspend a guide license. We agree with those changes. I did want to bring up other aspects of the Title VIII statutes that you may be unaware of. The guide industry has been very successful over the decades in monopolizing anything to do with making money from hunters. This is how outfitter got tacked on to guide, and now guides are known as guide outfitters. We have a member who is in his early 70s. He still likes to hunt. It's getting harder for him to pack out his moose to camp. He wanted to hire someone to help him, but was told by wildlife troopers that he had to be a licensed guide outfitter to hire a packer. This is under the unlawful act section of the Title VIII statutes. Does it make sense that a resident hunter long in years can't hire someone to help him pack out his moose meat? Why does the state take away the right for someone to do that?
Mr. Richards?
There are several other aspects of the Title VIII statutes that we hope you look into. In closing, Chairman Tarr, our main emphasis today is that we hope there will be an amendment to lower the extension period for this board to 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much, because we were running over there, so sorry to interrupt you. But if there's ideas that you want to send along to committee members, we will certainly share them with all the offices.
Madam Chair.
And Representative Tuck has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Richards, for your testimony. In your letter dated April 25th, 2019, you did say that nothing has changed in the terms of the caseload. The process has not been streamlined. Do you have suggestions on how to streamline the process? Because from what we heard from Ms. Curtis is that we're having problems with being able to investigate and being able to adequately monitor the cases. Is there something else that we can do as far as streamlining?
So here's the problem and why maybe the committee might be confused. There's only one investigator attached to this board, Mr. Strout. Mr. Strout cannot handle all the cases by himself. The board does not have money to hire another investigator. And one of the problems is that the way the board resolved its debt issue is that they moved to consent agreements over taking guides to administrative court hearings that are so costly. And so now guides with violations are basically being given a slap on the wrist, a minimal probationary period, and they're allowed to continue to hold their guide license. So we've kind of got a catch-22 here in that they're trying to resolve the investigative issues and the caseloads has resulted in something that's really going to allow guides to continue guiding with violations.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Richards. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Nate Turner. Mr. Turner, if you could please state your name.
Yes, hello, Madam Chair and House Resources Committee. My name is Nathan Turner. I live on the Nuwitna and Kantishna Rivers most of the year. I do have a place in Fairbanks where I'm calling from right now. Just as a frame of reference, I've lived in Alaska for 30 years now. I work primarily as a trapper. I've been a hunting guide for 22 years, a registered guide 19 of those years. And I served on the Board of Game for 9 years. I'm in the final months of my tenure there, I guess. And I was vice chair of the Board of Game for 6 years. I'm calling as a hunting guide today. I support both the proposed extension of the full six years for the Big Game Commercial Services Board and the amendments for the master guide qualifications. As you've heard, the board has very clearly acknowledged both the financial and investigative financial problems and investigative backlog, and continues to diligently work on the areas that they can through board actions and authority. As you've heard today, there's a lot of issues that are beyond them, and that's very evident from what's been presented. But the board takes these issues very seriously. For many years, most of the years that this board has been in, operating again, I've sat through meetings and I've participated in guide testing and a lot of subcommittees, and I've continually been impressed with both the sincerity of the individual board members who have been sitting there and the tone and the tenure of the meetings. To the main point of I'm sorry, I'm looking to my notes here. The I think the board, in the end, after this review process, and we go through whatever extension length that you give them, I think it should be considered down the road that the board, the sunset provision should be removed. And I think if you consider the the administrative problems that we're facing today are nothing in comparison to what would happen if this board actually was sunsetted. We can look at history and see that it was actually a lot of the problems in the field that led to the creation, the recreation of this board. I think it's a really important point to consider. As far as master guide qualifications, I support the changes. I've been qualified since 2012, but never submitted an application since I believe the bar had been low enough that it didn't really equate with my understanding of what a master of any trade should be. As it is currently, you don't really need to be a special guide or outstanding in any manner, but simply be in business long enough, and you'll qualify to be called a master. I believe that someone sees the title master, it should, especially if another guide sees the title master, they should be impressed.
Mr. Turner, earned it. Sorry, we're at 3 minutes, so I really could need you to wrap up if you could, please.
I'm finished. Thank you. Oh. Quickly.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And Representative Tuck has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Turner, you mentioned that you were 22-year a guide, and 19 of those years were registered. How does one become an unregistered guide?
Well, I was an assistant guide first to earn my qualification to become a registered guide.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Turner. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Virgil Umpenauer at the Fairbanks LIO.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Virgil Umpenauer. I live in North Pole. I've been here in Alaska since I returned from Vietnam in 1971. I've served three terms on the Board of Fisheries, and I was chairman of the Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory Committee for 8 years after that. Anyway, Alaska is well known throughout the country for our boards of fish and game and our Big Game Commercial Services Board. We have all other states in our 50 states are jealous of our system. To not reauthorize, and what they're jealous of is our public process, how we have our advisory committee system, and how the public process works as far as how our fish and game resources and our hunting resources are managed. And so it would be a total slap in the face to all the resource users, wild resource users in Alaska, if it was allowed to sunset. Our state is so much different from all other states in that the regular individual can put in proposals to change the regulations. We have a board process where those proposals get published, and then the public and the public through the advisory committee process, or just an individual or an organization, can come forward, come to the meetings, participate in the discussion of the pros and cons of changing the regulatory process. If we get rid of it, then we're going backwards. But that's the main thing I wanted to point out about. But anyway, I am a master guide. I've been guiding for 33 years, I believe. My son is also a master guide. And my daughter, who works at UAF, she's still an assistant guide. But anyway, it's a way of life here, and something no one said anything about is that the guides pay our own way. The non-resident portion of what their license and fees pays 73% of the budget of the Division of Wildlife Conservation, and the sport fish licenses pay for the majority of sport fish division's budget as well. So this is, it needs to just stay where it's at. And as far as addressing the investigation process, the board really doesn't have anything to do with the investigation process. The investigator works for the department. And so if they have problems, that's the department's problem. It's not really, the board cannot, does not supervise the investigator. I do know one thing, though, and that is that the board has gotten the investigator to quit initiating so many frivolous investigations that don't amount to anything.
Okay. Mr. Umpenauer, could we just ask you to please wrap up, because we're running short on time?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm finished.
Okay, we appreciate that. And again, if you have other thoughts and you want to send them our way, we'll certainly share them with folks. Thank you so much. And then the last person we have is Phil Moses, who's in the room here, or was in the room, it said.
He was. He's gone.
He's gone? Okay. Well, sorry we were not able to get to him before he might have had to go. That's everyone I have signed up. Was there anyone else in the room that was interested in testifying? Or anyone else online? Okay, I'll go ahead and close public testimony. We're going to set this bill aside until Friday, when we're going to take the bill back up. And we would ask that amendments be due by Thursday at 1 p.m. for distribution to members in preparation. And I think in this case, because there's quite a number of questions, I think if members would let us know if they are going to offer amendments just for the scheduling, because we have three bills up on Friday, and if there are going to be several amendments, we probably won't be able to get through all of those bills time-wise, so just will help us out a little bit with scheduling. Okay, so that takes us to our second item of business, which is House Bill 138. This is also the first hearing, so we're going to hear this today and set it aside for a second hearing on Friday. At this time, I have about 10 people signed up for the public testimony portion, and so hopefully we'll be able to get to that by, say, 20 till, see how this goes here. That gives us about a half an hour for the introduction and some initial questions. And are we waiting for Representative Kopp? Okay, we'll take a brief at ease. I could ask folks to please take their seats so we can get started, just because we're a little bit short on time.
That's Mr. Mosher, but he may be that he was actually here for 138. I'm not sure.
Okay. Mr. Moses, were you here for Senate Bill 138? Okay. Well, that's good, because we had you signed up on the wrong bill then. Okay. So, or House Bill 138. Pardon me. Representative Kopp, if you would please join us.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, State House Representative for District 24. I have here with me my staff, Mr. Ken Truitt.
For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present House Bill 138 before this committee today. What House Bill 138 does is it clarifies that designations of outstanding national resource waters, a process commonly referred to as designating Tier 3 waters, would be accomplished by the legislature through statute. The Alaska Constitution places the responsibility for significant land and water use decisions in the hands of the legislature. We recently had one, I believe it was last year, when Representative Rauscher ran through a public use area bill for up in his district, which we all voted on, and I believe we got that across the finish line, legislature designating a special use area. Under Article 8, Section 7 of the Constitution, it says the legislature may provide for the acquisition of sites, objects, and areas of natural beauty of historical, cultural, recreational, or scientific value. It may reserve them from the public domain and provide for their administration and preservation of use, enjoyment, and welfare of the people. Likewise, Article 8, Section 2 instructs that the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of the people. A good example of this express constitutional mandate in practice is the 118 state legislatively designated areas in Alaska. Our refuges, our sanctuaries, our critical habitat areas, our special management areas, forests, parks, recreation areas, preserves, public use areas, and recreation rivers and recreational mining areas. These total nearly 12 million acres of designated lands of and waters throughout the state. So each of these areas were designated by legislative approval, not through an agency executive approval process. The Alaskan voters have clearly spoken on what they believe the ultimate authority should be with land and water use designation process. We saw this in 2014 when the voters approved by a margin of nearly 4-1 the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative, which was designated to give the legislature the final say in whether or not to allow the development of large-scale mining projects in the Bristol Bay area. House Bill 138 simply continues this strong precedent of ensuring significant land and water use decisions, in this case, Tier 3 water body designation, reside in the hands of the legislature. A Tier 3 designation bestows the highest level of water quality protection under the Federal Clean Water Act. This is waters that are deemed the highest ecological and recreational importance. In 1983, the EPA defined Tier 3 waters to be what I just said, exceptional recreational and ecological significance. So its water quality will be maintained and protected from degradation in perpetuity. The EPA further mandated that each state establish a process for designating these outstanding national resource waters. Currently, we don't have a process. The EPA has asked us to identify a formal process for designating outstanding national resource waters. This puts the state at risk of violating the Clean Water Act, opens up the possibility for the EPA imposing their own designation process, which they have no interest in doing. So they wrote our former DEC commissioner, Larry Hartig, a letter in 2018 saying, we support Alaska's efforts to develop their designation process, and we do not have an interest in doing that for the state. So by so defining a designation process, this leaves conservationists and developers alike a measure of certainty in how to go about this designation. HB 138 solves this problem by codifying in statute a designation process that is consistent with how lands and waters across the state would be designated for conservation by legislative approval rather than by department or agency decision. This designation is an important tool for protection of human and environmental health, and it's a significant policy decision because it does come with a restriction of a wide range of activities, not only on the state water bodies, but on the adjacent lands that may have waters that flow across those lands down into those water bodies. So large-scale resource development projects would be impacted by Tier 3 designation. But other examples of perhaps less considered activities would be road and building construction, motorboats, recreational activities, seafood processing, municipal wastewater discharge, residential and commercial septic systems, stormwater discharge, landfills, timber harvesting, gravel quarries, and pits, all if they were located near Tier 3 watersheds. So such wide-ranging impacts effectively make Tier 3 designation, a de facto land use decision as well. As such, the final decision for Tier 3 designation, I believe, properly resides in the hands of the legislature. House Bill 138 does just that. It provides certainty for conservationists and developers alike on the question of outstanding national resource water designation process. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a brief introduction. You can see that the bill itself is
pretty brief,
is not lengthy. It just says that this should be done in statute by the legislature, and that's pretty much all it says. So we're here to take questions, and we have folks from Department of Environmental Conservation also standing by and other folks to help answer questions as well.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Appreciate the introduction. We do have online from DEC Earl Crafts. And so I don't know if any members have any questions now for the bill sponsor, staff, or the DEC folks. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cotton. So, so we don't know what the statutes or anything are going to be. How can, why not just come up with a bill that defines the process? Because if we have a bill that defines the process, boom, we're done.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck. So, good question. I would say the logical outflow of this bill would be that a nomination by an entity for a water body to be designated as Tier 3, it would be introduced. It would have to go to the DEC, so they know, but it would come in as a bill, you know, introduced through the House Rules Committee by request of the governor, the administration. In other words, the administration still would have a duty as DEC to document petitions brought forward for Tier 3 designations, but the way the legislature would know about it is by a piece of legislation, a bill that would be introduced probably through the House Rules Committee or the Senate Rules Committee by request of the governor when the administration brings forth the bills. That is how those are done now. So the question would become before that body in a manner we are accustomed to seeing it.
Okay, follow up, Madam Chair. Okay, so I get it. So we're not defining a process. We're just saying that the procedure is file a bill. If you want a designated body of water or river, file a bill.
Through the chair, yes, Representative Tuck, file a bill, get legislative approval.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Hannon and then Sponholz.
Thank you. I had a different line of questioning, but since Representative Tuck went there, could the governor already done that, and has this governor or any previous governor done that with any of the five nominations that we've got at, for the state waterways reprotected?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Hannon, for that question. So the five requests certainly before Governor Walker, and they may have even gone back to Parnell, that are outstanding right now. We had the same Commissioner Larry Hartig during that time, and Larry Hartig's his memo to DEC and to the legislature, two separate memos, both recommended an approval process where these decisions were made by the legislature, and that until that process was established, he did not feel we were in a position to show that we were complying with the Federal Clean Water Act as having a way to resolve these Tier 3 designations.
A follow-up? Which I guess, so why didn't they ever send the nomination forward and say the Coctuli should be designated a Tier 3? We've had that pending for 10 years.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, because this bill hadn't passed yet. And the question of how to do that is either one where you either have to have a statute that says it is done by the legislature, and I believe Governor Walker may have filed a bill, I'm getting a note here from my staff, that did this, SB 163. It was probably a couple of years ago. Apparently it didn't pass, but there was an attempt to do this, so I would say we're continuing that.
Okay. And follow up?
Follow-up. Now I'm going to shift gears. So, and I bet your staff has done the research to tell us this, so it may be for him.
He's a very good staff.
Rich, yeah, I've now figured out that it's our staff who gives us our real answers. Can you tell me how many states have a designated process and how many have it limited to strictly a legislative decision-making as opposed to a hybrid of the Board of Water makes a recommendation and then the legislature acts on it?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we have DEC standing by. I do know that there is a mix of statute, board or commission, or executive agency decision, but how those are broken down, I don't know.
Okay. Mr. Krapps, did you hear the question from Representative Hannon?
Yes, Madam Chair, I did. Thank you. This, for the record, this is Earl Krapps. I'm a section manager with the Division of Water. Yes, we do not have those broken down. We do have the summary of the different state processes. The process itself is not specified in federal regulation. It is up to each state individually to determine that process. We do know that each state does it differently. There are some that are legislative, there are some that are through a board, and there are some that a specific agency within the state makes the designation themselves.
Follow up?
Mr. Krapps, through the chair, are there any other states who the decision is exclusively legislature with no other board or department process preceding that?
Through the chair, I would have to research that a little further and get back to you. I don't know exclusively if there are states that make that determination in that manner.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And Mr. Krapps, if you could provide that to the committee, I'd be interested. I do have some documents about some of the western states, and so for, you know, Arizona, processing criteria and regulations. Nevada is a little bit different, New Mexico in regulation, Oregon policy processing criteria combined in anti-degradation policy regulations. So it looks like it's, yeah, it varies from state to state. So if you could share any information, that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. Sort of along the same lines, I'm trying to understand what the EPA considers to be an adequate definition to meet the Clean Water Act standards. Is having it in regulation enough?
Is that for DEC?
Yeah.
Mr. Krapps, did you hear that question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yes, through the chair, they do not, again, they do not specify. We do have a policy currently in place. And they have indicated that the policy we have, which indicates that these nominations be taken directly to the legislature for designation, is adequate to meet the interpretation of the Clean Water Act.
Follow up?
So you're saying then we already have something in regulation that meets the definition of the EPA's criteria to meet the Clean Water Act standards?
Through the chair, that is correct. We have recently, last year, promulgated our anti-degradation regulations, as well as posting our policy for the Tier 3, which indicates that these nominations be taken to the legislature, and EPA has indicated that that is acceptable.
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a Tier 3 waterway designation in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, no, there hasn't to this date.
Okay, so follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
So my understanding is that right now there are five nominations that are on the books, but the administration hasn't seen fit to bring any of those forward to the legislature so far.
Through the chair, that is correct. There are five that we are holding and have not brought those forward any farther.
All right, follow-up for the bill sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds to me like we already have in place the process that you're recommending, putting in statute. Why is it that you think that we should put in statute what's already in regulation, which is already meets the EPA clean water standards?
So this designation is so far-reaching. It's a political question. It is the highest designation of any water body use. In fact, it's so high that the state of California, which you and I might agree is probably far more restrictive environmentally than Alaska, they've only applied it two times. Mm-hmm. There's only two water bodies in California that have this designation. There are none in Nevada, and there's none in Washington. I believe there's one in Oregon, and there's none in Idaho. And you're right, there's none in Alaska. But this is a higher standard than even drinking water. And the reason why is because there are sensitive aquatic marine life microorganisms that are even more sensitive to humans for copper, things like that. So it's very high. And because its subsequent impact affects such large adjoining land areas that the thought of the administration is, you know, politically, if you maybe like a DEC commissioner or you like an administration, you would say, oh, yeah, I want them making that decision. And then it's like the whole good king, bad king thing. You know, if you like the king, great, let him run the show. If you don't, you think, I don't want. So the question is do we want these types of sweeping decisions made by an administrative agency, or do we want to have these discussions before a legislative body where we can talk about it collectively and express our collective will if we think this special use designation is what we want, and hear from the people rather than maybe get an internal agency report on their thoughts on the matter. And they, you know, every administration changes in its preferences, its wishes. This just brings the question before our legislature, would we prefer to have this highest level of designation done by this body? That's the question. Mr. Kendrew.
Yes. Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Spahnholz, I think part of the answer is also the timing of the regulations. I think perhaps they were done in concert with SB 63, which was introduced by Governor Walker, and pretty much set out to do exactly what this bill is setting out to do. You could say it was a little cart before the horse. The regs got into effect before the statute got passed, before the bill got passed. I think without the statute, there is currently an ambiguity in terms of, because those regulations point to the legislature, there's nothing currently in statute that says the legislature will do this. So this is kind of completing a process that DEC started, apparently in concert with the prior administration and their legislation.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just a little confused because it sounds like we already have regulations in place saying, putting into effect what you're describing in this law. It sort of sounds to me like we may not have a problem that needs solved unless, you know, the effort is to try to ensure that there wouldn't be citizens' initiatives that would, create a Tier 3 water designation. Is the intent to try to prevent a citizens' initiative from creating a Tier 3 water designation?
Through the Chair, Representative Spahnholz, I think you may be able to, I'm not sure what the constitutional implications are that with natural resources. I know there's some bright line tests the courts use on whether or not a resource can be done through the initiative box. I think we just had one done on the Kenai not too long ago. Mm-hmm. So I don't know the answer to that question, if this could be done through initiative. But I do know that this designation DEC considers to be so far-reaching that once a nomination for outstanding national resource water is made, it basically goes around most of the tools that they use to regulate water quality standards for normal water quality designations, and they would prefer this policy call be made by the legislature. But they are standing by. They may be able to provide some clarity, too, to some of your thoughts.
Sure.
Mr. Krapps, do you want to add anything to that?
Yes, through the Chair. I would like to clarify that the regulations that were recently promulgated only deal with how a Tier 3 water will be managed once it is designated. What I spoke to earlier is our policy. This is not in regulation. It is part of the information documents. So the policy itself, which is just a department policy, is the one that says the nominations will be submitted to the legislature for designation. But hopefully that clarifies the difference between what is in our regulations currently and what is only policy.
Okay. That clarifies that for me. Thank you.
I think I have one more question, and then when I have Mr. Andreasen come up, and just looking at the time, the goal for today, because this bill is going to be up again on Friday, will be to try and get through the public testimony for folks who've been waiting. Most have signed up at 1 o'clock. And so we are going to have this again on Friday, and we're not moving it this week. So I don't know if that if you want to have your question now, but just to give members a sense of where things are.
Okay. I'll hold my question for right now. Maybe I get answered along the way.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. Mr. Andreasen, would you please join us? A bunch of people just signed up.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 138. As you know, municipal powers, especially for boroughs, can include planning and zoning, transportation, ports and harbors, sewer and water, solid waste management, road maintenance, and flood protection and mitigation. Each of these relate back to Tier 3 designation. The role of local government is extensive as it relates to community development, public safety, and public welfare. Local decision making takes into account extensive public input and directly involves residents in a review of that development's impacts on lands and waters within city or borough boundaries. The designation of Tier 3 waters by an agency would impact local control and decision making, which otherwise would involve residents and locally elected officials in a dialogue about the sustainability of community development and locally determined approaches to the mitigation of negative impacts. Designation may adversely impact municipal wastewater treatment plants, for instance, or stormwater permitting. Alaska's constitution is clear in assigning to the legislature the responsibility for the administration of the state public domain and further the reservation of the public domain for special purposes. In our review of HB 138, we believe that the legislative role in Tier 3 designation maintains the separation of powers between the executive and the legislative branches, is consistent with constitutional intent, and further that the legislative process mirrors that found locally, the inclusion of Alaskans in a process that is overseen by elected officials. We commend to the legislature the importance of the role that local governments have in this process. Clearly, the conservation and protection of Alaska's waters is a meaningful discussion for all Alaskans. Just as important is Alaska's community and economic development. Clarifying the legislature's role in Tier 3 designations isn't making a choice between the two, but provides a platform for the careful negotiation that must take place with respect to both. Thank you.
Thank you. And could you please state your name for the record?
And affiliation.
Yes, of course, through the chair. Also Representative Tuck. for the record, my name is Nils Andreas, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League.
Thank you. Any questions? Are you available to come back on Friday when this bill comes back up? Because if there were any examples, it would be helpful in my mind for me to understand, like, the conflict on the wastewater treatment side of things and what that might look like. Is that something you feel like you might be able to do?
Chair, yes, we can be available and work with our members to identify what those examples might look like.
Okay, that'd be great. Okay, thank you very much then. We'll see you on Friday. We're going to transition into the public testimony, and I'm going to try to go in the order that people lined up. We've had some people waiting since before 1 o'clock. We do have to do a firm 2 minutes, and I'm terrible about interrupting people, but I'm going to have to do it. And so we're going to try to get through as many as possible. We really appreciate you waiting. First up is Kimberly Strong from Chilkat Indian Village.
Hello, this is Kimberly Strong with the Chilkat Indian Village of Clockwan. We're one of the communities that is proposing a Tier 3 status for the Chilkat River. I'm concerned about the process that is being brought forward. And first of all, I should have thanked you all for having the hearing and allowing me to participate. I am speaking in opposition of House Bill 138 as it politicizes the process very much depend on, as somebody else said, depends on what administration is in office. Usually the stability of statutes and things go through and isn't overturned by one governor after the next. And I think that if we put in the political arena, the decision into the legislative body, the process to give us a tier three or allow us to have a tier three, that it would become a political battle. And if I don't have enough funds available to fly down to Juneau and testify in front of you, I'm sure that, the other other organizations or mining companies or other companies who want to have resource extraction that could irreparably damage the river that provides five species of salmon for the people of the Chilkat Valley and the just all of the industries that go along with a healthy environment with our water. I'm thinking that Tier 3 designation really should be a process where environmental experts can make the decision. Is this needed to protect the waterways? When I've gone to DEC in the past asking them if they've done water quality testing in our Chilkat River, they said, no, there's too many waterways in Alaska for us to test. And so it goes untested for water quality. So,
Ms. Strong, could you please wrap up, please?
I'm not sure what the designation is going to look like when it comes out of a political process. I would rather it be a process that DEC decides. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next is Jones Hotch from the Chilkat Indian Village.
Thank you. I heard local decision-making is important in local government. Chilkat Indian Village is a federally recognized Indian tribe. Both bills in the House and the Senate should not be passed. There is no appeal process, and DEC should be the one that should be handling the nomination and selection.
Thank you, Mr. Hotch. Could you please state your name for the record? Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Hotch. We really appreciate your testimony today. Next, we're going to go to Shannon Donahue.
Opportunity to testify.
Pardon me?
My name is Shannon Donahue, and I'm calling from the mouth of the Chilkat River in opposition to HB 138. The Chilkat River has been nominated for Tier 3 protection under the Clean Water Act because of its exceptional ecological and cultural significance. Everyone and every living thing in the Chilkat Valley depends on this river for sustenance. This bill would deny Alaskans our right to protect our most valued waterways by creating a complicated political process for designation through the legislature, making it nearly impossible to achieve the protections that we have a right to as Alaskans and as Americans. Meanwhile, mines and mineral exploration companies go through a simple permitting process if they want to degrade these waters. This doesn't make any sense. Everyone in Alaska depends on our clean, life-giving waterways, but it's easier to get permission to pollute our waterways than to protect them. Tier 3 designation should be a transparent, reasonable, non-political process based on clear criteria, ecological, cultural, or recreational value, and the will to protect our waterways. This process should remain with the DEC through the triennial review process. Please kill this bill and defend our right as Alaskans to protect our water in our home. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. Appreciate that, Ms. Donahue. Seeing no questions, we'll go to the next individuals, Jill Jacob from Ketchikan.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Please state your name and give us your testimony.
My name is Jill Jacob, and I live in Ketchikan, Alaska. I'm representing myself, but thank you for this opportunity to testify. I want to make sure that it's critical that the authority for designating Tier 3 waters remain with the DEC and that the process remain administrative equal to that of permitting water. It's astonishing, Alaska has not got a Tier 3 water body yet. I know that Lake Tahoe in California is a Tier 3 water body. That does not stop people from swimming, drinking, or anything else. My understanding is that House Bill 138 would remove the option for a public ballot initiative to designate a Tier 3 water, and that it would also provide the way for a governor to veto a Tier 3 water designation. So since we have the last remaining healthy wild salmon on the planet, other than a few places in Russia, we really need to start protecting with the highest possible protection our water bodies. No amount of economic development is worth our safe drinking water or our fish. So I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jacob. We really appreciate your testimony. I'm not seeing any questions for the testifier. We're going to go next to Kip Kermoyan from Haines.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. My name is Kip Kermoyan. I'm representing myself here in Haines. And on March 20th of 2017, there were 43 residents that met in Juneau. I believe it was a state-sponsored workshop. And they formed focal groups specifically to address the process that the state should be employing to nominate and designate outstanding national waters and resource waters in Alaska. So in attendance, there were conservation organizations were represented by two people, commercial fishing by two, government had 11 representatives, industry had 16 representatives, Alaska Natives had 5, and the Upper Lynn Canal Fish and Game Advisory Committee had 2, and then there were 5 undeclared members that attended that workshop. They formed focal groups, and the one point where there was consensus among everyone was that none of the focal groups at the workshop expressed support for a legislative path to Tier 3 designation. And I think that's quite important. The opinion otherwise was split between an all-DEC DEC option or some combination of a DEC and a Tier 3 advisory board. And like those at the workshop, I do not support legislative option at all. I think this should be DEC along with an advisory board, and it should be evaluated for specific nomination paths and recommended to the DEC by this board, at least with stakeholders and a variety of other people interested or involved. Inviting the legislature to make this determination politicizes this process, and it should be left to natural resources and scientists, people with expertise in the fields. In the case of Tier 3, they would be evaluating exceptional, important, unique, and sensitive ecological waters. And I just believe that the transient political nature of how things go would not lend itself well to this process. We have corporations that can.
Mr. Kermoyan, I really need you to wrap up because your 2 minutes has gone by.
All right, thank you. Corporations can apply for a process to degrade water, and we're eliminating with SB 51 or HB 138 the ability for the residents and the public to do the same. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. We're going to go next to Betsy Burdett and then Jan Connitz, and then we're going to come here in the room to Doug Woodby and then Deantha Crockett. Betsy?
Hello, and good afternoon to everyone. This is Betsy Burdett. I'm calling from Ketchikan, sunny Ketchikan. And I'm calling basically on the same theme as everyone that's already spoken. I believe that this should all stay in the realm of DEC and some kind of advisory board. Let's see. And our legislators are doing a good job, but they're replaced every so often, and the same with the governor. So I'd really like to keep it more on the more administrative level and with the experts, the ones that know about the environment and so on. I also disagree that this
designation is a land use decision, because I thought we were talking about rivers and clean rivers. And there's a lot of these rivers already have things going on. So it's not like we're taking it off the grid or something like that. So that's my only comment, and thank you so much for taking it.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your comments today. Next, we're going to go to Jan Connitz from Fairbanks.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Jan Connitz. I'm a resident of Fairbanks, and thank you for giving people the opportunity to testify. I'm testifying on behalf of myself. Just reading this bill requiring the designation of state waters as outstanding national resources waters, and that, for that to occur in statute, sounds like a simple change, but it isn't. It's sweeping, and it takes away the rights of ordinary Alaskans, and over time it will result in great harm to Alaska's mostly pristine waters by taking away the right of people who know these waters to take steps to protect them. One thing unique about Alaska compared to all other states is the direct dependence of so many of our people on clean and unspoiled waterways. And those people are resource users of every kind, hunters, fishermen, rural residents, village and small town residents, Alaska Natives with subsistence rights and rights over tribal land. Those with a direct connection to the land and waters have close up firsthand knowledge of the waterways that need protection. And they know about the risk of not taking care of those waters. All Alaskans currently have the right to nominate these waters critically important as outstanding national resource waters. The designation protects waters from long-term pollution and degradation by simply not allowing dumping of waste into them. Surely this is a reasonable and responsible approach to taking care of our precious and irreplaceable natural waters. Its designation would not preclude ordinary existing uses of the water, such as boating, fish cleaning, camps, and waterfront houses with septic systems and so on. But the bill in front of you would remove the right of ordinary Alaskans to take the first step to protect waters that they depend on and care about, and it would turn efforts to reasonably protect the clean water over to a political process, which would probably, in practice, be nearly impossible to prevail over. The first person to speak today said that there had been no designation of Tier 3 waters by the legislature.
Ms. Connitz, could you please wrap up?
Yes. The legislature can at this time designate Tier 3 waters if they choose to. Evidently, they have not. But so there's no point in doing this bill to give them more authority. What this bill would do is take away the authority and the rights of ordinary Alaskans, and it would allow further degradation of our clean water. So I urge you just to put this away and not pass it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to go to Doug Woodby. Is Doug still here in the room? Then Deantha Crockett. Then we're going to go back online to Jessica Placha, and then Louis Flora, and then I'm going to hope to get the last three people in the room. That's the goal here. Mr. Woodby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Woodby. I'm a resident of Juneau, and I'm representing myself. I will say that I began working for the state fish and game in the mid-70s and retired a few years ago as a chief fishery scientist. And I've been around the state in practically all sections doing research and management work, and I'm opposed to this bill for a number of reasons, but primarily I believe it's making the designation of these waters, these exceptional waters, a political process when it should be based on best scientific expertise. As I look at the list of sponsors that were included with the bill, it's clear that, you know, a lot of these are extractive industries, and we have no waters now designated under this special designation, and it appears that this bill is a thinly veiled attempt to make that almost impossible. And so that's why I'm opposing it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you have any additional thoughts, please send them and we'll share them with committee members.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience. Ms. Crockett.
Good afternoon. My name is Deantha Crockett, and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. I was here a few weeks ago and gave an industry overview, and it's really nice to see most of you again. The ones that weren't here. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. You've heard that the Clean Water Act requires all states to maintain a process for Tier 3 water designation. This is for water that's described as having exceptional recreational or ecological significance, or waters that are within parks and refuge, so truly special scenarios of water protection above what the state of Alaska already does. Tier 3 waters effectively cannot have any new or any expanded activities that have the potential to change water quality in any way. So this would apply even in situations where the activity meets existing water quality standards and fully protects the fish and the water and any other uses. A designation would result in significant restrictions on land and water users and cause significant adverse and social economic impacts. Because the designation applies to a Tier 3 tributary or a Tier 3 water, it would prohibit development in entire watersheds comparable to de facto wilderness. And for that reason, we believe the authority to designate should lie solely with representatives of Alaskans, which is the legislature. With regard to the designations, they've got the potential to become tools for anti-development interests to block or delay projects. It's evident in the five nominations before DEC currently, which specify mining, oil and gas, federal land planning, and Alaska Native Corporation land selections as threats to water bodies. But it's clear that a designation goes a lot further. Tier 3 designation could impact a lot of other users, non-development users that the sponsor outlined in his introduction, so I'll omit it for the sake of time. And that's why you'll see in your packet a letter authored by 15 diverse organizations that understand the impact of a Tier 3 designation to all Alaskans. And we believe that given the significant adverse and watershed-wide land and water use impacts, that a Tier 3 water should be designated only by a vote to the legislature. This is consistent with the Constitution, the existing process for setting aside areas of state land from development, and existing DEC policy. And for those reasons, we urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will go to Jessica Placha with the Lynn Canal Conservation.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep. Please state your name for the record. We'll take your testimony.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for your public service. My name is Jessica Placha. I'm the executive director of Lynn Canal Conservation, a grassroots organization based in Haines. We have 300 active members. So as I speak, imagine 300 Alaskans speaking with me, opposing HB 138 and SB 51. LCC supports the village of Klukwan, which nominated the Chilkat River for Tier 3 protection. Clean water is not a partisan issue. Anyone who has ever fed a child or caught a fish knows that clean water is a basic human right. Alaska is blessed with abundant clean water, but despite its small population, Alaska is also the biggest water polluter in the country. We can do better than that. The state of Alaska has been out of compliance with the Clean Water Act for over 20 years. Citizens are demanding the right to protect our clean waters and healthy salmon runs before rampant industrialization makes our way of life history. Support for subsistence is built into the state constitution. It should not be easier to pollute public waters in the state of Alaska than it is to protect them. Opponents of protections argue that Tier 3 designation would be bad for business. Tell that to Florida, which has 41 designated Tier 3 waterways and a robust economy. We're counting on you, legislators, to resist corporate pressure and do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Let communities protect the waters they rely on using sound science, not corporate pressure and not politics as a yardstick. It's that simple. There's an alternate Tier 3 bill waiting in the wings, one that makes it easier to protect the water we all rely on for our health, our wealth, and our future generations. Wait for it. Please oppose HB 138 and SB 51. 300 of us here in Haines ask you to join us and oppose these destructive, backward bills. And please let us protect the Chilkat River. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. And if you want to send the written comments, we'll share those with committee members. Next, we're going to go to Louis Flora. And then the last three we have in the room are Guy Archibald, Sarah Davidson, and Heather Evoy. And so if you would be ready afterwards, that would be perfect. Oh, and Phil, pardon me. Phil. Louis, go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, House Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Louis Flora. I'm calling in from Homer, and I represent the Alaska Center. The Alaska Center respectfully opposes House Bill 138. We believe the state's top cop for water quality regulation, DEC, has the ability, expertise, and clear legal authority to establish a science-based nomination process for high-value water, or Tier 3 water, as required under the Federal Clean Water Act. We believe administration of the Tier 3 for waters of high ecological or recreational value can be rendered under the existing anti-degradation policy incorporated in the existing DEC Water Quality Standards Program, and that DEC does not need additional legal authority to designate Tier 3 waters. It just needs to adopt a process for doing that. We believe legislative designation of Tier 3 waters will result in an entirely political process where any discussion on the science-based merits of a Tier 3 designation will be steamrolled by politics and money. And DEC has the water quality expertise and the ability to regulate water quality, should be the entity to make the protective determinations. And the argument that in House Bill 138 is that Tier 3 determinations are too big of a policy call for DEC. And I believe this is a strange argument, since the EPA is currently moving ahead with certification of an Alaska water quality regulation promulgated by DEC in 2006 that allows pollution mixing zones and salmon spawning areas statewide. This 2006 regulation has far-reaching implications for salmon habitat and for salmon user groups statewide, and was carried out administratively. Yet with this bill, we're saying that to protect very specific and geographically limited waters of exceptional ecological value, the burden is too great for an administrative process. And then I just wanted to close by saying the argument that the agencies should not independently make determinations that protect certain waters ignores the statute that allows citizens, organizations, and state agencies to make in-stream flow or water quantity reservations through an administrative process overseen by DNR. And in fact, these reservations are made quite often by the Department of Fish and Game to protect fish habitat, and it's all without legislative confirmation or approval. So in closing, I believe House Bill 138 is not necessary and should not move from committee. DEC should, within its clear authority, create a regulation that satisfies the Federal Clean Water Act requirement. The states have a process for citizens to nominate specific high-value waters for protection from additional degradation. And thank you for your time, and I'll send in my written commentary.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Guy Archibald, we're going to try as hard as possible to get everybody in if we have just a couple more minutes that folks can stay.
Yes, thank you, Chair Tara and Chair Lincoln. For the record, my name is Guy Archibald. I'm the staff scientist for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. However, I'm testifying on my own behalf. I'm testifying in opposition to this bill. And I need to correct the record here a little bit. The sponsor's statement here and some of the talking points were imperfectly informed. It says that currently the state of Alaska has no formal process for designating a Tier 3. If you look back in your packets, there's the transmission letter from EPA to Sayers Fay. It mentions in the Tier 1 and Tier 2 approval that the EPA is approving this because the Department of Environmental Conservation still has in place the interim anti-degradation guidance that outlines three different ways to designate a Tier 3. One of those ways is through the triennial review process, where any resident of the state can nominate a Tier 3, and DEC is supposed to move that along. Nobody argues that the legislature does not have the authority to designate a Tier 3. The legislature can act on those at any time. They've always been able to do that. So if this bill is not a bill to form a designation process, then we must ask, what is it? It's clear that this bill is designed to take the public process out of it, so that the public process does not have an administrative process to, or even an appeal process judicially, to form a Tier 3. I hear people say that, well, protecting the water is so far-reaching, it has so many other, you know, effects. Well, contaminating water has effects as well. It affects other landowners, it affects communities, it affects people's ability to make a living through the fishing industry. It is not a land use decision. Landowners adjacent to our public waters have no right, there is no inherent right to pollute those waters. So it is not a land use decision, and I see Chairman cars look, and I am finished. Thank you.
Yes, I apologize that we're out of time. But if you could help us with the understanding of those points that you made about the three other ways, that would be helpful, and we could share that with committee members.
Yes, quickly, I'd mention that the Alaska Department of Law has done an opinion on this, but they've not made it public. They told me it was attorney-client privilege.
So okay.
You might right. ask for that one.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Sarah Davidson. And somebody's going to have to not take 2 minutes or we're not going to get the last three people in.
All right. Co-chairs and members of the Alaska House Resources Committee, it is my sincere honor to address you today. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Sarah Davidson, and I'm here on behalf of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, or SEAC. One of the distinct privileges of my job as the Inside Passage Waters Program Manager at SEAC is the opportunity to travel throughout this phenomenal region, speak to communities about water challenges and opportunities, and listen to their concerns, needs, and interests. Of the many concerns I've heard, those relating to the future of wild Alaskan salmon stocks have come up the most, a concern that I imagine is shared by many in this room. As stressors in the ocean ecosystem increase, our streams and rivers become even more critical to the survival of salmon and the communities that rely on them. Currently, most Alaskan waters are clean enough to catch fish and eat without significant health hazards. This is one of the few places on Earth where this is the case. That alone makes Alaska unique and fuels our two largest economic drivers in this region, fishing and tourism. We should be doing everything we can to protect that special quality and the waterways that make that possible. Instead, HB 138 makes it even more difficult than it already is to protect our clean waters and leads us down the same path from which other states in our country are still struggling to recover after decades of industrial pollution. It should be no more difficult to protect Alaskan waters than it is to pollute them. Not only does HB 138 make this process political rather than scientific by removing authority from DEC, it also removes the opportunity of Tier 3 designation by a public initiative. The same agency that has the scientific expertise to implement a Tier 3 designation should also have the authority to designate them through an administrative and science-based process. This is not my perspective alone. It is shared by over 150 people who signed our petition calling for a Tier 3 designation process equally as administrative and streamlined as the permit process to degrade our waters. Any short-term gains made by the passing of HB 138 will be undermined by the long-term detriment to our clean water, our healthy fish, and our resilient communities. HB 138 hurts all of us. I call in
your 2 minutes has expired.
I call in each representative on this committee to have the will and the courage to prioritize clean water for those yet to come by defeating this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have two people left, and we have about 1 minute before we have to come out of the room. So, Ms. Evoy, if you're able, and then Mr. Moses, because we really appreciate it, and I just regret when we run out of time. Apologies.
Well, thank you, Chair Tara and House Committee members, for the opportunity to testify here today. Emasa, Demilsh Kudishnu, and Heather Evoy Dowayu, Tsimshianyu Lakshkik Dehokshku, Ketchkan Adamatlakatla Diwawatku, Adajuno Diwodzogu. My name is Heather Evoy. I'm Tsimshian from the Eagle Clan. I'm from Ketchkan and Metlakatla, but I live here in Juneau. I am the Indigenous Engagement Lead for SEAC, Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, but I'm here testifying on behalf of myself as an Alaska Native whose ancestors have been here for 10,000 plus years, and I hope they will be here for the next 10,000. I am here to speak in opposition to HB 138. You know, almost 10 years, DEC has sat on these five Tier 3 nominations, and all of which have come from a tribe. And I just think it's an important distinction to note that these are Alaska Native tribes and not Alaska Native corporations. And I've heard proponents of a legislative-only Tier 3 process argue that Tier 3 is just a tool for special interest groups, but last time I checked, tribes are not special interest groups any more than any other government entity is. So I'll leave it at that. And Doik Shishim, thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you. And you clearly cut that off to get us out of here. Thank you. And then Mr. Moses, you're our last person. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Phil Moser from Juneau, Alaska.
Oh, Moser. Pardon me.
Moser. I'm not here to part the waters just yet. I'm opposed to House Bill 138. I'm representing myself today. If this bill passes, it would be a blow to the voice and well-being of citizens like myself. It's outrageous to me that smaller government and fewer regulation proponents are having a talking point that only applies to industry and capital. But when citizens have a tool to advocate for themselves and their health and the waters in which they rely, we propose adding more and more bureaucracy to stop them. The Department of Environmental Conservation is set up precisely to work through Tier 3 water issues and can respond to community advocacy well. By shunting Tier 3 designation to the state lawmaking process, we lose a straightforward, fact-based investigative process to political stalling. If business can apply to the DEC with a 6-page application to engage in long-term pollution of our best waters, why are our own citizens, in protection of those same waters upon which we rely and live on, considered that much more of a threat? Whether this passes or not, the evidence already says that we have many stressors to our water, and we need to do everything we can to uphold our waters as the cleanest and best waters that we can for our own citizens. And Tier 3 designations as well do not apply to existing uses of those waters. So I believe the statement that this legislation, if it's not passed, could be onerous to people is much overstated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moser. Really appreciate it. We got through everyone, so thank you very much. We do have this bill up on Friday, and we'll move back to committee discussion. And again, we're not going to move that out on Friday, so just people don't have to feel worried about that as far as time to understand things that were brought up today. We do, though, want to ask again for amendments on the Big Game Commercial Services Board for Thursday for Friday's meeting. Wednesday, we have the AOGA presentations. If there's no other business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 3:13. Thank you, everyone.